there's an expression you might hear on a regular basis. Money is the root of all evil. This version of the expression has likely taken root as a result of one of the most popular albums of all time, Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, and specifically the song Money.
Money, so they say, is the root of all evil today.
But the expression is biblical and slightly different from the one penned by Roger Waters. In Timothy 6:10, it is written that the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, and that those craving it can be led to pain, pangs, and grief. At John Brookins' trial, the prosecution would claim that John Brookins brutally took the life of Sheila Ginsburg and left her grieving daughter Sharon without a mother. But the defense would claim that Sharon had a dark side, and that her love of money was her motive to murder her mother.
And welcome to Undisclosed, The State versus John Brookins. This is the second episode in a four-episode series about John Brookins, who was in prison for the 1990 murder of Sheila Ginsburg, and who might be closer than ever to being exonerated. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan Story, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
In episode 1, we explored the competing timelines regarding the murder of Sheila Ginsburg. According to John Brookins, on December 20th, 1990, he was helping Sheila clean her apartment for the upcoming visit of her son, Barry, the next day. He claims that he left Sheila's apartment at about 5 p.m. to go to a friend's house and returned an hour later at about 6 p.m. to see Sharon murdering her mother.
And that's when I see her daughter standing over her, which appeared to be stomping a pair of scissors in her mother's chest, cussing and screaming.
The state would counter that Sheila Ginsburg was alive until shortly after 11:30 p.m. that night, which is when Margaret Albright, who lived in the same apartment complex, last heard a woman screaming about being attacked. But Margaret Albright lived in a unit that was across the parking lot from Sheila Ginsburg's unit. And her story, which she told for the first time more than a year after the murder, is called into question by Mary Dredge, who lived in the unit directly above Sheila Ginsburg and could often hear her TV playing in the unit below. At around the same time that Margaret says she heard screams, Mary was either in her unit, in the laundry room that was across from Sheila's unit, or right outside Sheila's door.
Because one of my first trips down, I was going to knock on her door and give her Christmas card. Mm-hmm. And I didn't because the TV wasn't blasting, and so I figured she drank herself to sleep. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't go back downstairs because I had such a horrible feeling.
Mary wasn't the first person who used that laundry room that day to have a horrible feeling, but she was the only such person whom the jury heard from at trial.
I was like, well, wait a minute, nobody never knocked on the door.
No one ever knocked on
the door. I remember knocking on the door. I would think if that happened back home, she would hit all of these.
Right, so no one ever knocked on your door to ask you any questions?
I never left a card, a detective card, or anything.
What if they had knocked on your door? You probably, what would you have done?
I would have said what I saw. I would have told the truth for somebody, a lady died. Okay. A lady died.
That's Chevelle Durant. She lived in the same apartment complex as Sheila Ginsburg back in 1990, directly above the laundry room. But as she notes, despite her proximity to Sheila's apartment, she never heard from anyone, from the prosecution or the defense. But John's wife, Karen, was recently able to track her down, and both Karen and Colin were able to speak with her. Now, it's important to note at the top that Chevelle can't be certain what she observed was on Thursday, December 20th, but she does remember that what she saw and heard was right before Christmas.
It was around, I know, it was around the holidays. It was right before Christmas.
And Chevelle also remembers that it was not on Christmas Eve, the weekend, or Friday, December 21st.
Friday before Christmas, I probably would have been getting ready. I definitely was getting ready for Christmas with the kids.
That leaves a solid chance, but not a certainty, that what Chevelle saw happened on Thursday, December 20th. So, what did Chevelle see?
And is it right that on that same night you saw Sharon Ginsburg and an African-American man entering the apartment?
I did. Yes, I did.
And when was that?
That was before I went down to get the kids' clothes, before I went to the laundromat. Because I was looking out my window, which I often did at that time. I had a radio in my window, and I would listen to music, and I would look out the window. And I remember seeing her walk past the entrance of my side of the building. I'll tell you, her mother lived on the other end of the building. So she walked right past on the sidewalk, right past. But she didn't see me, I don't believe, anyway. But her and another man, they walked straight on by.
Now, we know what you might be wondering. Was John Brookins the man with Sharon Ginsburg? And the answer is no. Chevelle has given a statement to a private investigator that John was a kind man who was best friends with her children's father. And, according to Chevelle, quote, "I know what John looks like, and that was not him. I don't know who the other person was." Unfortunately, that's about as much detail as Chevelle remembers about the man.
Do you have any recollection of the physical features of the man that she was with?
That I don't remember. I don't remember what he looked like. I remember maybe like an average-sized man. I don't remember what he looked like. I'm so sorry.
Fortunately, Chevelle does have a somewhat better recollection of the time when she saw Sharon and the unidentified man.
And when you saw them, was it still sunlight or the sun set at that point?
At that time, I want to say sun, it was setting, like dusk. Like sunset, like dusk. Not, it wasn't bright out and it wasn't too late.
And Chevelle also remembers where they were going.
And were they walking in the direction you would have walked to get to the entrance to her mother's apartment?
Yeah.
John Brookins' wife, Karen, was actually able to get Chevelle back into her old apartment so she could re-experience the view that she would have had of the people walking by.
As long as they're going straight on by. Now, it's hard for me to see who's coming in unless they're walking over. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
But once they get past here, I can see them coming straight on up. Once you pass either one of these windows.
In other words, Chevelle was able to confirm that she had a room with a view. A clear view of Sharon and the man walking right towards the building where Sheila and she lived. And in her statement to a private investigator, Chevelle estimated that she saw Sharon and this man approximately 15 to 20 minutes before she went down to the laundry room that was next to Sheila's unit.
I was going down to get the laundry, to get the clothes out of the dryer, my kids' clothes at the time, and I heard a commotion. I heard people arguing, like yelling, and I said to myself, I'm like, what in the world is that? What is going on? And I amped up a little bit, you know, that so I can hear it clearer. And I heard someone yell, you know, a female yelling, give me the money, give me the money. And it was this hustle, and I heard this thump, thump, and it frightened me.
John Brookins' wife, Karen, was able to take Chevelle back to the laundry room, where she expounded upon what she remembered.
Yeah, I could hear it. I mean, You can hear the scuffling. You know what I mean? And I remember something about give me the money. And she might have been saying she didn't have any money. But I was trying to listen, and then you heard the tumble. You know what I mean? Whatever, the scuffle, whatever. And then it was a drop, like a thump, like a line. And she was only, that's what I heard. I don't know if it was a hit, I can't tell you, or if that was her just hitting the floor.
Right.
The carpet. So, because I don't know if she was stabbed or anything.
Yeah, so you heard scuffling and a thump, and give me the money.
It was quiet, and it was real quiet, and then that's like that.
Chevelle is certain of the gender of the person who was demanding the money.
And the voice you heard was a male voice or a female voice?
Female.
Okay.
And she's also certain of where she heard the conflict occurring.
And do you remember which direction that voice was coming from?
It was coming from the other end of the laundromat, the other end of the building, like the other side of the laundromat. It's you can enter the laundromat from either side of the building. From the side that I lived on, and from the side that the woman lived on. The side that incident, you know, the side that everything happened on.
So her apartment is on the same floor as the laundry?
Yes.
And you're saying the voice came from the same area as her apartment?
Yes.
Just to be clear, you're saying that Sheila's apartment was right next to the laundry room.
I want to say yes. It was right next to the laundry room.
Okay.
What Chevelle heard was enough to cause her to make herself scarce.
And so then you got scared and ran back up to your apartment?
Right. At the time, I didn't know what had happened, what had occurred, but it was enough to where, though, it did frighten me. I remember that fear. I was very young, and I ran up. I was a young mother, and I ran back upstairs.
After that, Chevelle kept herself scarce for about a week, starting on Friday evening, meaning that she was not present for the discovery of Sheila's body or the immediate aftermath.
And when did you first learn that Sheila had been killed?
I went away. I didn't learn that till maybe, almost maybe about a week later. I was over at my mother's. So, I want to say around a week.
But Chevelle was back in time to hear the rumors that were circulating about Sheila's murder.
And did you ever have any thought about speaking to the police, or did you have reasons not to volunteer information?
Well, when I did tell my mother, she was just like, if nobody asked me about it, you know. But I figured that everything was taken care of. I was very young and very naive.
As noted, though, no one from the state or the defense ever knocked on Chevelle's door. And she made the decision not to come forward with what she knew.
Were there rumors going around the apartment complex after the murder about who had done it?
A lot of people said it was her. She was telling people that she killed her mother.
So here we are, 30 years later, wondering whether Margaret Albright heard Sheila Ginsburg saying a man was stabbing her at around 11:30 p.m., or whether Chevelle Durant heard a woman demanding money from Sheila Ginsburg at dusk, followed by a thump. The medical evidence would certainly favor Chevelle Durant. As we noted in episode 1, a forensic pathologist testified at trial that Sheila Ginsburg had no defensive wounds and was likely knocked quickly unconscious from a blow to the head before she was ever stabbed with the scissors that were left embedded in her chest. That testimony is entirely consistent with Chevelle's claim that she heard a quick argument over money, followed by a thump, followed by dead silence. And it's entirely inconsistent with Margaret Albright's claim that she heard an altercation while watching the nightly news, followed by a woman shouting about half an hour later that she was being stabbed. And then there's the issue of motive. The state wanted the jury to believe that 26-year-old John Brookins had a fatal attraction with 58-year-old Sheila Ginsburg, and that the killing was sexually motivated. As support, they presented evidence that Sheila's bra was pushed up, exposing her breasts. But the story was complicated by the fact that Sheila's pants were on and buttoned, and there was no obvious evidence of an attempted sexual assault. Moreover, the pathologist would testify at trial as follows.
My opinion is that this is not a sex-dependent crime. It's merely a violence-dependent crime. And if someone is determined to do someone in, they are able to gain the strength. If they are angry, if the adrenaline is flowing, they are determined, deliberate. They are under the influence of drugs, alcohol. If they are in a frenzy, so to speak, you know, this is not necessarily a sex-dependent crime, meaning male or female. It is merely a willful crime. And if one has the strength, yes, they can carry out every single one of these injuries.
But if Sheila Ginsburg's murder was not a sex-dependent crime, why was her bra pushed up? Well, one theory is that this was a love-dependent crime. The love of money.
According to numerous witnesses, Sharon Ginsburg was always trying to get money from her mother. For instance, her best friend Agnes Wilkie would testify that Sharon was always demanding and stealing money from her mother, and would also steal food out of her mother's freezer. And here's Betty Marucci, who was the foster mother to Sharon's son, Ricky.
Do you know anything about the relationship between Sharon and her mother, Sheila?
She was always trying to get money off the mother.
Uh-huh.
Whenever the mother's check came, she knew it.
Indeed, Betty would testify that she spoke on the phone with Sheila Ginsburg early on the afternoon of Thursday, December 20th, the day that she was murdered. Part of this call consisted of Betty saying she didn't want Ricky going back with Sharon, which was consistent with her low opinion of her.
She was a bad alcoholic. I can remember my last husband, he died, but she was going down the road, and he was coming down, and she propositioned him.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a mess.
Right, yeah.
She was a dirty old girl. She never had any time for Ricky.
But Betty would also testify that Sheila told her she'd recently had a bad fight with Sharon, and that she was really upset with her that day. Betty's claim is corroborated by a woman named Patty Clark, who volunteered at the Veterans of Foreign Wars post in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Patty Clark claims that Sheila Ginsburg came to the VFW on Wednesday, the day before she was murdered, and said she'd had a big fight with Sharon, involving words and shoving. According to Clark, Sheila said that Sharon would steal money from her and that their fight was about Sharon trying to get more money. This then ties back to Betty Marucci, who says that the fight was about Sheila and Sharon's impending trip to Florida to spend time with Sharon's brother. Betty says that Sheila told her that she wasn't going to put up with what she had put up with on their last two trips to Florida, when Sharon didn't have any money and ended up leeching off of her and her brother. And so Sheila had devised a plan.
What they didn't tell during the trial either is that Agnes Wilkie, who was Sheila's good friend, she told the police and she gave statements and she told them Sheila was avoiding phone calls for days up before the murder, saying Sharon kept banging on her door, Sharon kept calling her.
I remember
her,
that
she was afraid to answer the door because Sharon wanted her money. Sheila was collecting money. Mm-hmm. Sheila told you that too? Or Agnes?
Collecting money from who?
She was taking money from Sharon during her welfare checks, like a couple dollars every time, so that when they went to Florida, they would be spending money for Sharon because Sheila wasn't spending her money for Sharon.
Right.
And that's the money that Sharon wanted, and that's the money that Sharon took from her that day.
The money was gone. And I know for a fact that she had always planned and saved. I drove her to the airport to go to England one year, and the money was gone.
That's John Brookins' wife, Karen, speaking to Mary Dredge, and she's accurately describing what Sheila's friend Agnes Wilkie said, which is that Sheila was having Sharon give her a portion of her welfare checks to hold so that Sharon would have spending money in Florida. And, according to Agnes Wilkie, Sheila would keep this money in her bra. This, of course, takes us back to the crime scene and the discovery that Sheila Ginsburg's bra was pushed up. As noted, given the lack of other evidence of an attempted rape, this lifted bra was not evidence of a sex-dependent crime. But if the killer knew where Sheila kept her money, pushing up the bra would make all the sense in the world if the killer was motivated by hate and also the love of money. For her part, Sharon Ginsburg says she was never at Sheila's apartment complex on Thursday, December 20th, or on Friday, December 21st, until about 5:30 p.m. But there are a few problems with her claim. First, in her initial plea statement, Sharon says that when she did arrive on the 21st, her mother's door was locked, despite the fact that her brother arrived to find the door unlocked and his mother murdered less than 2 hours later. Sharon would later try to walk back this in a subsequent statement by saying she half-heartedly tried to open Sheila's door and just assumed it was locked, which seems pretty unconvincing. There's also a second problem for Sharon, and that's her unofficial stepfather, Dan Lydon, who had introduced John Brookins to her. In his first police statement, Dan confirmed that he saw Sharon on the afternoon of Friday, December 21st, as she was leaving to go to her mother's place. But he would also say that Sharon told him she was going there to pick up money that she left there the day before. In other words, Thursday, December 20th, the day that Sheila was killed, and the day that Sharon claims she was never there. A third problem for Sharon is a witness named Mary McGrath, who didn't testify at trial, but who also contradicts Sharon's timeline. Colin recently found her witness statement deep in the discovery files from the case and spoke with John's wife, Karen, about her.
She supposedly was a woman that lived in the houses near the apartment. And Mary McGrath saw Sharon.
Yeah, like 9 a.m.
around. Even, I think it was earlier, wasn't it?
She's estimating 9 a.m. because she routinely dropped her grandchildren off for school at 9. Well, she estimated 9:10 because she says she dropped her grandchildren off and then saw Sharon at the Lakeview Manor apartments.
Yes, hanging around the front of it.
Uh-huh.
And that was Friday morning.
Friday morning, yeah.
That was Friday morning. Yeah. So do you need a statement? You need that? Need to find that statement?
No, I have the statement as well. I just wonder why, if you know why she wasn't called at trial or if anyone's contacted her. Because that seems pretty important.
Okay.
Obviously, it contradicts Sharon's statement that she didn't get there till like 5 or 6 p.m. that night.
Yeah, which really it was 5 or 6 p.m. Thursday night.
Right. Yeah, just in terms of her own claim, yeah.
Right, Mary McGrath was on the witness list, but I think there's something I read somewhere where the police said no such person could be found.
Okay.
They act like they researched her and they couldn't find her.
Okay.
Like it was an anonymous call or something weird, but no doubt Mary McGrath exists and they didn't want to use her, so maybe we can find her.
We haven't been able to track down Mary McGrath yet, but as noted, she clearly remembers seeing Sharon at Sheila's apartment complex at about 9:10 a.m. on Friday, December 21st, which is 8 to 9 hours before Sharon says she ever arrived.
On the other hand, Colin was able to track down another witness who says that she saw Sharon even earlier in the morning of Friday, December 21st. And she could be the key to cracking this case. Her name is Patricia Jackson.
And so, how do you know John Brookins?
I was married to his cousin.
And that's Tony Jackson?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And did you know Sharon Ginsburg back in 1990?
I met her through Johnny.
Back in December 1990, Patricia was working the night shift.
And at the time in December 1990, I think you said you were working from 3:30 p.m. until 12:30 a.m. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And what was the job you were working?
I was working at a place called Frito-Lay.
Patricia would tell the police that that night, she'd finished her shift at 12:30 a.m. on Friday, December 21st, and she'd gotten home at around 1 a.m. She went to bed, but she and Tony were awoken by someone knocking on the door between 4:30 and 4:40 a.m. It was Sharon Ginsburg.
Yeah, she came looking for Johnny. She thought he was at our house, but he wasn't.
And then you said that Tony replied, "No, why? What are you doing here at this time in the morning?" And do you remember Sharon's response about this kind of traumatic event that had happened?
Oh, she said her mother was dead. I remember her coming, saying, yep, that her mother was dead, but she didn't seem, you know, she didn't seem upset.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one thing I do remember when, you know, you found your mother dead, you know, naturally you was, you know, hysterical. And why are you looking for someone if your mother's dead? You need to be dead. I don't know, things was just crazy.
Specifically, in her police statement, Patricia recounted Sharon's response as follows. Quote, "Well, my mother's been murdered. She was stabbed in the chest with a pair of scissors." Obviously, if Patricia is correct, this is devastating for Sharon. She claims that she did not learn of her mother's death until after her brother Barry discovered the body hours later on the 21st. Patricia's timeline would contradict that claim and call into question Sharon's culpability. And for that very reason, the state tried to discredit Patricia, claiming that she'd had her days mixed up and that she must have seen Sharon early in the morning on Saturday, December 22nd, and not early in the morning of Friday, December 21st. But Patricia's adamant that it was Friday morning. And once again, money could be the key to this case.
And you probably don't remember this, but there was a back and forth between you and the prosecutor where you were saying that this was early Friday morning and they were saying it was early Saturday morning. Do you remember anything about that in the day of the week?
Yes, I do. And how I told him I remember was that I had my paycheck. When you work second shift, you get paid on Thursday night. So I had my check when I came home. And they kept trying to tell me, no, it was an uh-uh. That I do remember.
Mm-hmm. And so you still had the paycheck. You hadn't gone to the bank or wherever to cash that check.
Right. Yeah, I got it. You know, you get off from work, 1 o'clock in the morning, you go home, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I still had my check. And I wish, you know, if I knew all that was going on, I wish I could have, I was looking for the pay stub so I could have showed them the date on it. You know, we always got paid on Thursdays. Second shift, second and night shift, always got paid on Thursday.
But there's also another reason that Patricia must have seen Sharon early on Friday morning and not early on Saturday morning. And that's because we know that Sharon was with John Brookins early Saturday morning. We know this because Sharon was seeing a man named Paul Cotman at the time of the murder. Paul confirms Dan Lydon's claim about Sharon going to her mother's place in the late afternoon on Friday, December 21st, and then recalls detectives coming to Sharon's place to take Dan and him to the police station for interviews later that night after Sheila's body had been found. Paul then says that after he was taken back home, Dan and he found Sharon, and Sharon and he went to the police station so that she could be interviewed. The police then took Sharon and Paul home late that night, with Paul saying that John Brookins later arrived between 12:30 and 1:30 a.m. John Brookins agrees with this timeline and says that it was his attempt to get Sharon to turn herself in.
Later, this would be late on Friday, early into Saturday, you went to see Sharon at her place, right?
You want to come up for a ramble. We're at their house. It was like a big crowd of people out there. It was her. I seen all happening out there. I was just a mishmash. Mishmash. It was just not a lot of different people out there. So when I seen her, I said, listen, we need to have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened
out here in front of my brother's house. My brother Pete, my brother Ricky. So he was parked in front of his brother's house. Talking about the event and how she has to turn herself in.
Paul Kottman again corroborates John Brookins' story, saying that he saw John and Sharon together in John's car later that morning after he'd woken up. Now, Paul, of course, can't confirm that John was trying to get Sharon to confess. But the key point is the timing. If John and Sharon were together from about 12:30 or 1:30 a.m. until later that morning when Paul had woken up, there's no reason that Sharon would be at Patricia Jackson's place between 4:30 and 4:40 a.m. looking for John Brookins. Because, of course, Sharon already would have been with John in his car.
There's one final piece of this puzzle, and that's where Paul Kottman and Dan Lydon found Sharon on the night of Friday, December 21st. But it's a piece of the puzzle that's been missing for years. In his police interview, Paul Kottman says that after Dan and he were dropped off at Sharon's place after their initial police interviews, they found Sharon at a neighbor's place. That neighbor being a woman named Gay. Seems like a pretty important witness, but she didn't appear in the trial transcripts that we had, and there were merely elliptical references to a woman named Gay Gillen in the discovery. Well, it turns out there was a missing day of testimony from the trial transcripts containing the testimony of a witness named Gay Gilliard. I recently spoke with John Brookins' attorney, Craig Cooley, about this discovery.
I don't even recognize that name. Who is Gay Gilliard?
Yeah, so this is the initial transcripts that I got from Karen. It was missing her day of testimony, but then she subsequently got it. She testified on July 15th. She said she lived seven doors down from Sharon, and that Sharon, on the afternoon of December 20th, came over to buy drugs but didn't have money, came over later that evening with a roll of money an inch and a half thick and bought drugs. And she remembers it was Thursday. And what the state tries to claim is, well, you don't know it's Thursday, December 20th. But then she says, well, I remember on redirect, I think, the next day, Sharon was back over at my place. And that is the night that I guess Daniel came over and told Sharon that the police were there and that her mother was dead.
What day was that?
Gay Gilliard's testimony is exactly how I described it to Craig Cooley. She says that Sharon, who was on welfare, came to her place on the afternoon of Thursday, December 20th, with no money to buy drugs. Then, Sharon miraculously returned later that evening with an inch and a half thick roll of 50s and 20s and bought some crack cocaine. And then, despite the prosecution's best efforts to claim this could have been another Thursday in December, Gay specifically recalls Sharon returning to her place the next day to buy more drugs, which is the same day that Dan came over to tell her that her mother was dead and that the police wanted her to come down to the police station. While trial counsel didn't do the best job of pinpointing the day that Gay Gilliard saw Sharon as Thursday, December 20th, it now seems crystal clear that she did see her that day, and that her testimony provides a pretty clear motive and narrative for Sharon committing the murder. Sharon had no money for drugs. Sharon knew her mother had some of her money and some of her own money, and so Sharon killed her mother to get all of that money so she could feed her drug fix. It's a seemingly compelling theory, but it's also one that the jury rejected at trial. But what if there are other witnesses who claim to have seen Sharon with a wad of cash and at her mother's apartment complex around dusk on Thursday, December 20th? And she was asking for a ride. How was she acting?
She was like fidgety, nervous like.
Uh-huh.
Fidgety and nervous and yelling and cursing. She wanted to get over to the terrace, which was that's where the drugs was at.
Next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to this episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer,
As always, I'd like to thank our sponsors. You can support us at patreon.com/undisclosedpod, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.